Hey, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on Tuesday, November 24th, 2015. I'm Myrot, and this is Rolo T. Chris, how has your Tuesday been?
This is uncomfortable, and I'm not entirely kosher with doing this on Tuesday, Nick. It's thrown off my whole week-long feng shui, as it would be, you know? Yeah.
I do like how we do it normally on Wednesdays, because it gives us more time to digest the Jump chapters, and also we don't have to worry about doing a live reading of Fairy Tail. We just have it all prepped and stuff. But couldn't really do it tomorrow, because got, you know, holiday plans sort of getting in the way, preparations to be made and stuff like that, so had to do it a little bit earlier.
It's weird to me, because I would just naturally say, like, well, obviously, we can't do it on Wednesday because of the holiday. But then I realized, despite the fact a lot of our viewers are from America, there are quite a lot that aren't. And for those people, they're like, what fucking holiday are you talking about? Nothing's going on this week. And you're like, no, it's like the second to third-ish biggest holiday of the year is coming on the horizon right now. So, yeah, for those of you who may not know, which I feel like nobody shouldn't not know, be in the dark on, I feel like America really enforces its own self-importance enough that you should realize Thanksgiving for us is coming up. But if not, Thanksgiving is coming up, and so a lot of preparations have to go into that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. And, yeah, so couldn't really do it Wednesday. So sorry for those of you who that screws things up for, but let's just do this. We've got most of our series to talk about this week. We've got no World Trigger, though, and we might not have Fairy Tail, but we'll get into that when we reach it.
Yeah, and for those of you who are wondering why World Trigger is off this week, it was sort of an unexpected illness on Ashihara-sensei's part. But hopefully he's supposed to, he's recovered and he'll be back next week.
Good. So yeah, let's do the recap portion, Weekly Manga Recap. Kicking things off with Black Clover, as we normally do. Page 39, The Mirror Mage. As we open up with said Mirror Mage, it's that Black Bull with the Sister Complex. What is his name? I forget.
Say it a couple times in this chapter. Something like
we'll get to it.
Garouche or something like that.
Basically, he's beaten up this entire mountain of guys on his mission. And he has shown them no mercy because it's his little sister Marie's birthday. And so, yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, basically caring nothing for the people who he is hurt and maimed and so on and so forth, because he's so obsessed with his little sister. Yep.
This is really a cultural thing, though, right? Because I've never...
Cultural thing?
Yeah, like the obsession with a little like sibling relationship or something like that. Because it was also a big thing in what was the Ibitsu, that series with like the girl who was like, "Will you be my big brother?" or something like that, and then, you know, she beat people with a sledgehammer.
I do think it is a little bit of a cultural thing. I mean, it is something that is considered to be, you know, unhealthy generally. Mm. Siblings being obsessed with each other. But it is a more common thing in Japan than it is in Western culture, I think.
Yeah, that's the impression I've been getting. Because I don't feel like I see a whole lot of that in America. And I don't feel like I see... Because I feel like if there is this sort of relationship, it's purely just legitimately incestuous. Like, it's like Ultimate's version of the Maximoff twins kind of relationship. Where, like, you know, they bang each other on the side, too. Like, ew.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
it's full of a lot of that.
I don't claim to be an expert on this particular thing. I do acknowledge, however, that, you know, I have seen a lot in like anime, manga, and, you know, stuff like that that comes out of Japan. Not nearly so much in Western works. So I do think it's a bit cultural. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So yeah, he is obsessed with his sister, and he's happy because it's his little sister's birthday, and that means he gets to go visit her because. He's, for one thing, a former prisoner, now working for the Black Bull, so got a criminal record, and she stays at an orphanage, and he's apparently only allowed to see her on one day of the year, which is her birthday. So he heads off to see her. He's got bags upon bags of toys for her.
Like, overflowing.
I mean, like, there is more bag than man going on with all the stuff that he is carrying around, basically. And his nosebleed, he even acknowledges, like, ah, oh, my nosebleed is already unstoppable. He reaches the orphanage place, and he sees Asta is there swinging a little kid around. And I do like it, or he's like, wait a minute, I know that moronic face. That's our new guy. I think Pasta was his name. That is a great name for Asta.
I hope that becomes his new insulting, derogatory nickname.
Pasta.
Like, fucking Pasta's back.
So, Asta quits swinging the little... Actually, he's swinging two kids around at once because he's all muscular and stuff. One hanging from each arm. And so he puts them down. He's like, all right, you're next, Marie! And immediately the guy is like, how dare you do that? And, like, steps on Asta's face. He's like, get away from her! And Asta's like, wait a minute, you're that guy with the nosebleed in the sister complex! Yes, he is. Yes. And, yeah. Gonzalez, I guess, is his name.
No, it's Skarsh, isn't it? Mistakenly calls him Gonzalez.
Yeah. Right, I got confused because I thought he called him something even worse than that. I thought Gonzalez was really... Insane. Oh, so this is your little sister, Gonzalez? It's Gosh! Something very weird happens because Asta's like, oh, you know, see, this is Rebecca from the restaurant. She showed up again, Chris! Ha-ha!
Rebecca...
Next chapter.
Rebecca is not going to be an important character if once a week... Nick can remind us that Unohana is dead and never coming back. Then once a week, I will remind you all that
Rebecca
I too
is not going to be an important character.
I too can be wrong about things.
So what is it?
So mark my words, Nick. Rebecca
again, next
will not be an important character.
You gotta like do that every single time that she shows up or something.
Yeah,
that's a good rule because I mean she doesn't. Then it'll be, like, special when she does show up.
I swear to God, if she's going to join the group, it's going to be once a week.
It's going to be hilarious if she just, like, becomes part of the main cast, but then it'll be special when she puts in a little appearance.
Yeah.
So it's a win-win. I like this. Yeah. So, yeah, Asa's like, yeah, this is Rebecca from the restaurant. She's my friend, and I just came by to play, and Marie's cute. And Gosh immediately steps on Asa's face again. Of course she's cute. Now keep your hairy eyeballs off of my sister, you pervert. Like, you're one to talk, dude. So, very weirdly, Marie says, oh, big brother, don't be mean to Asta. I'm going to marry him.
He turns to stone and breaks apart and dies.
Yeah. I mean, we actually see him, he has the whole turn to stone thing. That's one part of it. But then as we are, like, cutting over to Noelle, who is still following Asta around, yeah, he crumbles into little pieces of rock. So, yeah. Let's go over this a little bit here. We've got Rebecca. We've got Noelle. We've got Marie. All having different obsessions with Asta. Romantic style obsessions.
In just this chapter, because there's also
In just
Mimosa.
This chapter. Mimosa 2. I mean, how many more fucking times... How many more female characters are going to have this thing with Asta? Like, is this turning into a harem series? I'm serious now. I'm not joking around about how I was like, oh, I'm so sick of Asta. I am serious. Like, is every female character we encounter from now on going to join Asta's harem? His oblivious harem?
I feel like it's amusing in the sense, like, if it almost becomes a running, like, a running gag that 90% of the female characters are like, oh, Asta's so awesome, I love them, and he's still pining after that fucking nun from the beginning of the series who doesn't like him in that way at all. Like, yep. It's different than the, like, chaste hero or the oblivious hero, because he does want to bang the nun.
Right.
He just can't, and he just can't see...
His problem is that he wants to bang a nun.
Yeah, he can't see that the rest of them are around him.
Can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I guess this is preferable to everyone asking Gowers to be like, you peasant, you can't accomplish anything, you can't be the Wizard King because you're a peasant. I definitely prefer, oh man, that muscle-bound little shrimp. Want to get on that. Mm. It's slightly better. But still, it's weird. So, Gaush is very upset that now his sister is, even if it's like a little girl puppy love crush, she is in love with someone. And he makes this very horrible face, because not only is he bleeding from the nose, he's crying tears of blood, and like he's got a vein bulging in his cheek, and he's like, "I'm gonna kill you, Asta." He's so scary. Ugh. But he is approached by I'm assuming she's probably like the Mother Superior or something. She's an older nun, and she says, "Oh, come on, we've got to get back to the church now." "Oh, what are you doing here, Gaush?" And she's like, "Hey, old hag. No. I'm sister. Don't call me old hag. Well, Maria is going on a date with me, so go home, old sister hag." And she's like, "No, you go home, sister complex punk." And just like trading insults back and forth about how awful the other one is. And of course, she's absolutely right, because he's being mean to her, and he's being a pervert, and he keeps on telling her to die. Like, she's obviously in the right, but I just like how they're being so petty with each other. Yeah. And Asta's like, "You shouldn't talk to the elderly like that! Shut up!" Asta, basically. So, the sister takes Marie away. And of course, Gaush is upset. And it's like, "I'll see you tomorrow. It's tomorrow, Marie," basically. And Noah's like, "Oh no! I followed them, but that lady from the mixer is here!" And they're going back to her house! No! And Rebecca starts getting harassed by her younger siblings. They're like, "Are you going to marry Asta?" "No, Marco, no, I'm not going to do that." "You should go and jump him tonight." Ah! "Pervert little sister, what's wrong with you?" So, yeah, everyone in the world of Black Clover is pervert. Unless they're Asta, in which case they're an idiot.
What's her name's pervert, right? Noelle? She hasn't really done anything.
She's too busy being Sunsun to be a pervert.
Yeah, she's although obsessed.
she does have very weird dress habits, but I don't think it's because she's perverted. She's just,
yeah, I think it's just a weird, because we've also seen, like, with
her
the
family, like, nobles just dress like weirdos.
Well, it's not just nobles. I think in this world there just happens to be an awful fashion trend going around where it's like we like to wear skirts that aren't skirts, because I also think to that scientist girl and like her fucking pearl necklace skirt, I think there's just a bad fashion style going on right now.
It's just like some perverted fashion designer is somewhere hollering in the court, be like, "They fell for it." Yes.
Like this is going to be like those fucking Kanye West glasses in 20 years in the Black Clover world. They're going to look back, they're like, "Why did we wear those skirts? Those were ridiculous." Shades, yeah.
Maybe. So, Gaush actually tries to kill Asta in his sleep. Yeah. I mean, he just does. He shows off his, like, mirror-based magic, which he can use to sort of shoot laser beams, and also to make a perfect double of himself somehow. And, you know, Asta wakes up to try to defend himself as Gaush attacks, and Gaush says, "Your crime is having met my sister!" And it's like, doesn't that mean that, like, everybody's a criminal then? Gaush is not listening. Asta gets blown out the window, and lands outside the church. And Asta's like, why is it snowing? Because, I mean, it's this big old image of this entire, like, churchyard, and snow is covering everything, and it's still falling, and Gaush is like, "Nobody cares, die!" Just keeps on shooting him. But Rebecca comes running in, she says, "The kids are gone!" So, yeah, I mean, we actually, like, end the chapter there. So we had the little brief story last time that introduced Rebecca, and this time it looks like we are having to save some kidnapped victims, maybe.
Nah, she's not gonna be next chapter, Nick. She came in to say that one line.
She won't even explain
what happened. The kids are gone.
Suddenly gain the ability to talk in order to explain to Asta what he's gotta do.
You know, she said it very, like, matter-of-factly, as though we are out of milk. Like, the kids are gone! Yeah.
Just wanted to let you know.
But you're going off into a snowstorm, so have fun. And she's just not going to be in next week. Because, remember, Nick, Rebecca is not going to be an important character.
Right.
So
I almost get the feeling that this was like some, they're probably not even in danger. Like, they probably just went off somewhere and hid. So they're like, "Yeah, now you got privacy, big sis." Yeah.
Now you can jump on him all you want. And there's another dude, too.
In fact, there's two of him.
Yeah, you can have a four-way.
And the guy was just like, "I'll only do it if you wear this bag over your head and my little sister's face on."
I'm like, that's so fucked up. I don't like you anymore.
Like, oh, suddenly all the little pervert kids are like, that guy is creepy as hell. Wait a minute. You're obsessed with your sister, too. Fuck off.
What
a weird chapter.
I like this chapter, though, actually. I actually got Mind Gouge. I know some people are kind of turned off by his sister gimmick.
He's so creepy.
He is creepy, but it's like
he's memorable, though. I'll give him that.
He's memorable. Also, I just like that the nun treats him like shit. Like, she's like, I don't think you should hang out with him. And part of it's because he's a criminal, but you also have to, like,
You're an asshole, too.
Well, that, and it's also just a good reminder, like, the Black Bulls are supposed to be hated. Like, they're just supposed to look like a group of misfits that nobody really likes. You don't get that impression a whole lot, and maybe that's not necessarily
Unless it's to say, like, they're all losers, they're not real Magic Knights, and also they're peasants.
Yeah, but I just like the idea of seeing, like, a Gouge being treated kind of like, oh, no, you're like a scum, you're terrible, you have mean eyes, you just stay away from your sister, you know?
Right.
I like that. And he has a weird gimmick with the sister thing. I don't, watch enough manga, or read enough manga or watch enough anime that I've seen this character trope pop up all that frequently, so it's not, like, old hat for me. And I like his mirror power. I think that's, like, a cool magic style, so... This chapter ultimately worked for me. It was amusing enough. I don't know what the hell happened at the end. I don't know if it's like they got transported to another world, or if maybe...
I think that's someone with ice.
Snow powers. Ice powers, yeah. Because that was what the whole gimmick of that first group was, right? The guy had ice powers, so maybe someone aligned with that group.
I don't know, possibly, yeah.
Or just snow powers, I suppose. But anyway, I mean,
the major villains they've fought so far have all had to do with that organization, so.
Yeah. So, I enjoyed it for the most part. I think it was an amusing enough chapter. I think Gouge can be an intriguing character. And I think that there's something cool in this aspect, too, that, should the series continue on for that long, far down the line, I think they're going to be able to turn this joke of him having these affections, like, being obsessed about his sister, into a really good dramatic moment in the case where maybe his sister's life is on the line and he has to kind of act on that. I think something like that could really endear him a lot, too.
All right, well, let's move on to Bleach, chapter 652, The Suicide... The theater suicide, scene 6. Last time, Nanao got her Zanpakuto unlocked, her family's Zanpakuto unlocked specifically, which supposedly has the ability to just kill gods somehow. And so we get her facing off with Lilibaro, and Lilibaro being like, oh, that sword, it's shining so bright, I can't even see the blade. And Nanao says, that's good, because this sword confronts God and reflects his power, so if it seems to be shining to you, that means it is reflecting the light of God you're emitting. And then Lilibaro's like, bitch, what you talk about? Oh, well, thanks for calling me God. So Lilibaro's been making some great faces lately, because he's like, I'm an owl, I'm gonna twist my head upside down.
What am I doing? Who knows?
Whee! I'm an owl! So, then now... lunges forward to attack Lilibaro, and we get a flashback to her overhearing this conversation between her mother and Shunsui, where she basically entrusted the Zanpakuto to him, and she said, you're not going to encounter any misfortune if you hold on to this sword, and you're the only person outside the family that I can trust, so please, take care of it. And then we basically get this thing, I guess... Nanao did not initially know exactly who Shunsui was, because she didn't actually see him conversing with her mother at any time, but basically there was one point where Shunsui came to her home much later on, and he was wearing a kimono that was very similar to one that her mother had owned, and also his hairpins looked exactly like hers. So by the time that she actually joined the court guards, he had stopped wearing those things. He was wearing a different kimono. He wasn't wearing the hairpins. But basically, now she knew that she already knew by that point that he had connection to her mother. We cut a bit ahead to her passing, like, the Shinigami exam, getting assigned to Squad 8, and pardon me. Yeah. Basically just goes over a bunch of information, like, I actually managed to pass this stuff without being able to, you know, transform the Asauchi, the, you know, blank Zanpakuto into my own. But my talent for Kido was recognized, and I was given the chance to take the enlistment exam. And I figured that I would, you know, maybe be a Kido user, because, you know, you might not recall this, but
there's a
Kido core that just uses it. That's what, yeah, exactly. Hachi and Tensei. I think, not Tensei.
It's in that same...
Tenpai? Urahara's assistant, dude. They were the two heads of it. And, yeah, so, yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I was thinking, like, oh, you know, I have Kido talent, so I kind of figured that. But she says, you know, but for some strange reason, I was actually made part of the Shinigami Corps, and I was assigned to Squad 8. And she immediately recognized Shinsui from when she had seen him in that middle period when he first showed up, when she was a little bit older.
Tessai. That's his name, sorry.
Oh, it was very close, wasn't it? Yeah. So, at that moment, you know, she knew, okay, this is the guy that talked to my mother back when I was a little kid. He's the guy that was entrusted with this. And this is basically by saying, this is how she knew that her mother had entrusted the Zanpakuto to Shinsui. So I was like, okay, that all makes sense. That all makes sense. And it does actually answer the question, who's like, how the fuck did she become part of the Shinigami without having a fucking Zanpakuto? It's because Shinsui pulled strings, man. You're just like, nope, having this little girl who is my niece in my squad, fuck y'all. But apparently, also, she became his vice captain, and maybe she actually is actually just a good enough Kido user that she actually earned it. Who knows? Anyhow, so, back in the present, she uses the Shiken Hakyoken to attack Lilibaro, and even though it has no blade, it cuts very cleanly into his arm, and actually cuts his arm off, and there's this big old blast of energy. So Lilibaro's like, you know, I did have a feeling that was a weird sword.
I don't know why, for that one half second, you spoke like you were a 1920s reporter, like, I had a strange feeling there was something in that sword, it was rumbling, tumbling, bumbling down my body.
He's a 20th century reporter. He's no longer Sniper from TF2.
He was like, I'm closer. Look, it was giving me the shivers. It was the bee's knees. It was the stingiest of those bees.
Oh, you should have made sure I was there with that first strike, old gal. Going to summon a giant ball of energy and kill you. I'm a messenger of God, don't you know? Yeah.
Good luck trying to kick it back on the archers there, kid.
Ah.
Then we get a flashback from Shinsui's perspective. I don't know exactly what the hell is going on here with Ukitake talking. Shinsui says they're talking together, and Ukitake says that someone has been executed. Mm-hmm. And then Shinsui's like, oh, I'm glad that you told me that. And he's thinking, you know, I think that I figured that it was my fault. You know, why does this happen? Everybody passes, leaving their most precious possessions to me. Don't they know I'm not comfortable with responsibility? And we get a bit with him, and I guess his brother.
I presume that's the brother. I'm still not entirely certain who they're talking about being executed. I have no idea. People are saying it's Nanao's mother, but I didn't expect her to have been executed.
I don't know. Maybe it's because she lost her family's treasure? I don't know. It does seem as though it's like, there are details that aren't being specifically given yet, and I imagine that in the next chapter, as this fight continues on even further, that we're going to get some more information, because it doesn't feel like we're done with all the flashbacks and stuff.
I'm baffled that this fight's not done yet. I know I shouldn't be shocked, but I'm still like, holy shit, we might not even be done next week.
Well, yeah, we're a month and a half into this fight and still going. So, basically, Shinsui, you know, was entrusted with the hairpins from Nana's mother by his brother, who I guess she gave them to him. So Shinsui basically is just relating, like, he's not comfortable with having to take on all these possessions that people have entrusted to him. He doesn't like having to carry on that responsibility because they're dead, you know. And he also doesn't, but at the same time, he's like, you know, I can't allow you to go out there on your own, but so I'm glad that you know took the burden of the sword away from me, but I've got to help you now. And he as Lilibaro makes the giant orb of energy to strike Nanao, and she kind of freezes up, a shadow casts from her body behind her, and so Shunsui is able to emerge from it using his Zanpakuto's ability, and he puts his hand over hers on the hand of the blade and says, "Are you ready?" So, like, you know, standing together with her, even though she is the one who's wielding the sword, which I think is nice.
What'd you think of the chapter, Nick?
I didn't dislike it. I think this is, again, one of those things where it's like, it feels like once we get the whole thing, it'll probably make more sense, and I can make a judgment based off of that. This is a very middle part of everything. It's just like, you know, add a few more details and stuff. There was no tremendous revelation in this chapter. So, I mean, I'm going to wait and see, basically.
I think I liked it for the most part. I like that it touched on the now and basically answered the question I had last week, like, how did she get into the 13 court guards if she's never had a Zanpakuto of her own? Like, I'll explain, she's always kind of been trying to make it as a keto user. And there's a little touch here where she talks about how she was taken in by an elderly couple she never met, and it, I mean, I might be assuming here, but I believe that's supposed to indicate it was Shunsui's parents who took care of her. Because the father, or the, you know, the husband in that relationship really seems to have like an older version of Shunsui's face, particularly in the mouth.
Mm.
So that's kind of what I was reading into. Like, Shunsui has essentially been watching over her ever since that moment, and kind of been looking out for her along the way. And it's interesting. It's sort of like the two of them have, or at least he has, kind of a father-daughter relationship with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way it kind of touches at the end. I mean, I guess I would have loved a moment where now just, like, you know, fucking gets her sword. She's like, "All right, time to murder something now," and you know, kicks ass. But for someone who's never held
fucking
one,
sword before,
yeah, for one of those moments, it's kind of fine for her to stumble at first, and for him to basically kind of pick her up and put, like, the "All right, let's try it again." Kind of, you know, give her that steady motivation she needs to come out ahead on that. So I think ultimately, the way this fight looks to be ending is radically different than how I expected it to go when things kind of first started. And I think this end is going to be a lot more enjoyable overall.
Well, and also, like, how many fights have we really seen so far that have involved a captain working together with their lieutenant?
Not many. I guess technically Mayuri.
Matsumoto and Hitsugaya combined their powers in order to use them against Baz B. That's the most recent example. Mayuri exploits Nemu and uses her basically as a puppet, and then she bailed him out in that fight against Master Hand, Crazy Hand. During the fake Karakuritan arc, there was one very brief moment where Omaeda tried to help out Soifon, but it was just like he grabbed a guy from behind and then he got thrown away, and Soifon kept on fighting the guy, basically. So, not a lot of examples of the captain and the lieutenant are going to specifically work together in order to bring down this foe. And so this moment with Shunsui standing together with Nanao united with both their hands on the one sword feels quite unique in Bleach. It feels very different from a lot of the stuff that we've seen. It makes the fight feel very different from a lot of the stuff that we've seen so far. So, yeah, I'll give credit where credit's due. It seems like it's doing something very different with this that, like,
there we go, Nick. Could this be a turning point?
No. It's an isolated incident. Unohana Stand never coming back. Let's go.
Buddy Strike.
Buddy Strike Chapter 2, A Heart That Trusts. This one's going to be a lot shorter than the first chapter. The guy that they beat in the pitching matchup last time is upset about it, and then he realizes, wait a minute, that catcher is the Grim Reaper, so, you know, you had nothing to do with actually being me, Arakami, it was all that guy. And then, all of a sudden, a guy that they describe as Gorilla Butt, which is a great nickname, basically is just this giant teacher, presumably he's like the disciplinarian of the school, comes running in, realizing that, you know, they're hanging out where they're not supposed to, and
I just want to note, I had a teacher exactly like this back at school who had a butt chin just like that, and we used to call him Butt Chin secretly because it was Catholic school, and if you said that out loud, you could have been eaten
with
the ruler.
You will say Bum Chin, sir.
They're like, we had one teacher who used to threaten us by saying she was going to take us out into the football field, tie us to a chair, and beat us with a wet pool noodle. And she was a very old woman. It was an absurd...
A wet pool noodle?
It was a very absurd and specific threat that
Do
always...
Do you have any idea how little that would hurt?
I guess if it happens for a while, though, it'd be very annoying.
I mean, if you give it some snap, it can sting a little bit, but... Do you realize how little control you have over one of those things?
There's no way you could
consistently hit on an area that would actually hurt.
It was one of those threats that I was like...
It would just look vaguely sexual.
That's the thing. You're like, I don't want to find out if it's true, because this may not hurt, but this has got to be something to this that I don't want to be a part of. This is too
weird.
She's
not just going to hit you with it. She's going to just hold the other end of it up to her crotch and rub it in your face.
Yeah, she's gonna walk out in dominatrix gear, and I'm just gonna be sitting there. I'm just like, oh, okay.
Girl, you're like 200 years old. Please stop.
This is not the fantasy I had about nuns.
And she's like, I just thought that she's like, you know, those old people that don't understand S&M, the kind that read 50 Shades of Grey and think it's like amazing and forbidden and stuff. And just like, this is what S&M is like, right? You use wet pool noodles on people.
No, in no version of S&M do they take out wet pool noodles, I believe. I don't know for certain, but I don't think most of them do.
So, anyway, butt chin teacher, Gorilla Butt, comes running, and everybody runs off, but Arakami is briefly distracted by Kaname running away, and he's saying, like, hey, I'll be back, bye! And so Arakami is the only one left around when Gorilla Butt appears, and so he is forced to clean all the toilets and the bathrooms as punishment. Some of his friends, I guess, just show up. I guess some of them decide to help out. I think the guy with glasses is specifically not helping out, and he's just like, just to like hang out with you guys.
He's kind of just checking out his hair.
The other guy, the catcher, he is holding a broom or mop of some sort, so it does seem like he is helping. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Arakami is, you know, talking aloud with them. He's like, I don't know why the hell, you know, he chose to team up with me. So this is very weird. I don't get it. I mean. So Aoyama suddenly appears, peering over one of the toilet stalls. It's sort of the top half of this picture feels like it's from a horror series, and then you look down and realize that Arakami is wearing rubber gloves and holding a toilet brush, and it's like, okay, so it's not at all.
Yeah, it's just weird.
So Aoyama's like, oh, you don't believe me, huh? So Arakami gets kind of pissed off, and I'm like, what are you doing, you know, coming in here with all this stuff? And Aoyama says, oh, you know what, I want you to play catch with me again and stuff. And Arakami's like, oh, well, you've done with me. I'm stuck here cleaning, and you want me to just, you know, go back and play some more bucket baseball with you? Screw you. And Aoyama's like, well, okay, I'll help you out. I'll clean the bathroom for you tomorrow. And Arakami's like, no, do it now!
I don't want to do it, though.
So, later on, they... Arakami and his friends follow Aoyama on the train to some place. They don't even know where they're going, but eventually they arrive outside of Yokohama Seiryu High School. Sakegahama Ball of Grounds. Had to make sure I got that. And so they freak out because it's like, oh, Yokohama Seiryu, we're in Kanagawa, which has the most fiercely contested district in high school baseball, packed with powerhouse schools. And among all those schools, the one with the most coaching appearances is Yokohama Seiryu High. At the helm with a coaching history of 40 years and dominating coaching in every era is the great Chūzō Kijitani. That is another weird name. Chūzō Kijitani. Almost every year, he produces both pitchers and batters who qualify for the draft, and he has trained many a professional player. It is truly Japan's most prominent baseball high school. And they're like, oh, and look at that. That's Iguma, the monster first-year slugger who's already been noticed by Japanese professional baseball scouts. Oh, he's a star as a first-year and stuff. Oh, man, and look, he's huge. He's caught Major League's eye. Look how huge he is. Look at his butt. What a weird comment in the middle.
Yeah, that was like a weird...
It's like all this stuff's like, oh man, he's a starter, and as a first year, he's already hit 16 home runs. He's been picked to play for the All Japan National Under 18 team. He's caught the eyes of the majors. He's so big. Look at his butt.
It's strange because you're like, you know, there's a lot of ways you could easily describe someone's physique to be like, wow, that dude's built like a brick shithouse. Like, look at those shoulders. Like, look at those arms. You know, look at that neck. It's so muscular.
Look at his ass.
Why'd you go right to, like, look at that butt? It's like, does the butt even get much of a workout from hitting?
Well, I guess hip movement is very important. So, I don't know.
Like, that wouldn't really do much for the glutes, though.
I mean, so it's kind of funny because, like, the picture before that comment is made, the panel before, is a close-up on Iguma from behind, and his butt is rather prominent in the picture.
Is this going to be
It is almost centered on his butt.
Is this going to be the reverse cross-manage where every so often we just get shots of this dude's butt?
Man, Kaito really missed out on a chance for some great man service right there.
He really did. Like, he's like, fucking the dude's you're like, oh, I dropped my gum.
Look, you've got Kaname right there, crouching, squatting, with his legs spread, ready to receive the pitch. Gotta focus on his crotch, man. Come on.
Kaito needs to realize there's a very large market of Yaoi fans that he could market this series to.
I don't know why I was calling Kaname Aoyama earlier. My bad. So, Kaname says, we're here to challenge that guy. And they're like, what, seriously? What are you doing? And then he just yells out at all the team. Is like, oh, I'm Kaname Odoa, catcher, and this is Ryo Arakami, the pitcher, and we are challenging you guys, you know, because we're going to blow you all away. And Arakami, like, lunges over and slaps his hand over his mouth to shut him. He's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? He's like, oh, you know, just thinking, you know, we got to take on a challenger and stuff. Come on, you know, you need to trust in me, Ryo, so we're going to take on this guy and beat him and stuff. And Arakami just keeps on chewing him out. And Aoyama eventually says, look, you don't need to have trust in me. What you need, and he sticks his hand right in the center of Arakami's chest. He says, you need the ability to trust yourself. Don't believe in me who believes in you. Don't believe in you who believes in me. Believe in you who believes in yourself. Kind of stuff. And so he's like, look, you know, you asked me why I wanted to team up with you. The pitches you throw are filled with smoldering spirit. I just felt like I wanted to liberate that spirit and catch it. You want to win, don't you? Knock him down. Aren't you tired of curbing yourself? Together, the two of us can become Koshien's strongest battery ever. And we're going to take on that monster slugger Kosuke Iguma right now. Bah! That's the end of the chapter. Arakami makes a wonderful face.
It is a great face. Because, like, at first you're like, what is that supposed to be? But if you, like, just look at the panel before, you can see it as, like, the further away, more comical version. It's like, oh.
And then you get that really realistic version of this.
I forgot how great Kaito's art can be, particularly when it comes to comedy. Because you can generally, like, easily transition between the two of his, between his artwork, because his dramatic stuff is very realistic. There's a lot of, like, detail put into the face. But the comedy stuff is almost defined by how unrealistic it is at times. This is, like, the one exception, though, where, like, it's something about seeing, like, the curves of his face, like, around the mouth, where it just drives home just, like, how speechless this dude is right now. All that's really, like, missing is just a sound effect that makes no sense. Like, or some noise that's just being emitted.
Yeah, so what did you think of this chapter?
Like it, but I don't... it's one where... I feel like we're not going anywhere quite yet. Like, we've still kind of not hit into the real pace of this series. This is an interesting challenge. We're going to fight the best batter in Japan... I presume that they aren't going to win. Maybe they'll come close, and that'll give our main character the motivation he needs to you know, go to the Christmas Bowl and all that.
Right.
But it's right now, I'm just not quite into. Like, I feel like the series just needs more at this point. Like, I don't know. Like, I almost have to go back to Ice Shield. I guess it wasn't that long after the start of it that they played Ojo, right? And
they played Koigahama.
They played Koigahama
as like a warm up, just to show off. Oh, you know, yeah, Senna is really fast and stuff. But they were into that around chapter 5 or so.
Yeah,
it did take a few chapters to them being like, you know, this is how we practice. This is the Daemon team. You're going to join this team, and so on and so forth. I mean, I do think that we're going to need a little bit of time to see what's going on. And I mean, we're gonna need to see more than one random pitching exchange in order to see how good this series is going to be, basically.
I think there's just something like the series needs to introduce before I can get invested. Because I think this is the pitcher-catcher dynamic may be different, but I still feel like there's too much that doesn't feel all that extraordinary about this series quite yet for it to really fit in. Like, there's only two characters, essentially, in this manga right now. I mean, he has his white-haired friend, but I couldn't really tell you much about him. It's just these two right now, and I don't know, I kind of feel like I need a little bit more to get super invested in this series.
Right. Okay. So I think that's going to do it for that. Do we know if Fairy Tail is available yet, or should we move on to Food Wars?
Fairy Tail is not available as of quite yet.
Let's hit Food Wars then instead. Shukiyaki no Soma, Chapter 144, The True Strength of the Alchemist. We get a flashback into Azon's past, basically, you know, people interviewing prospective students and stuff on why they want to enter Totsuki Academy. And so some people are like, oh, yeah, you know, I want to gain experience and inherit my family's restaurant. You know, one's like, I want to go to school because it has great history. One's like, I just want to, you know, learn all sorts of different types of cuisine. And eventually you get to Azon, and he just says, because it'll make me money. So, I mean, hey, you know. The heart loves what it loves, basically.
Yeah, you know? I want that fucking cheddar, yo.
So then we cut back to the present. We get this, basically just this whole page dedicated to just Azon taking off his glasses and rolling up his sleeves. And just like, yep, time for this guy who's, you know, been behind the scenes so much to actually get his hands dirty. And the judges are really, really excited about this. They're like, oh man, we're going to actually get to taste Azon's real cooking. This is awesome.
I love it because the manga is treating it like it's as much of a big deal as everyone else has been. Like, all the readers have been like, we haven't seen this dude cook before. What's he going to do? And everyone in the manga is like, we haven't seen this dude cook before. What's he going to do?
Right. This is, you know, the first time we're going to actually see him try. You know, it's a stark contrast to when Soma, you know, was like, he's not, you know, putting his heart into his cooking. The last Shokugeki that Azon participated in.
And I've heard a lot of people suggest, like, maybe that's the only reason why he's in the Council 10s, just because he's really good at the business. Maybe he's not that great of a chef, but they pretty much state the exact opposite.
Azon, it's interesting because it's clear that Azon did not have a plan in mind. He, I guess, set up these ingredients and stuff, but he didn't really care what he was going to make going into this, and so he just kind of looks over his ingredients and he's like, all right, now I know what I'm going to do. He went into this with absolutely no plan because he figured that he could just beat someone in other ways. So perhaps, that will end up being his undoing somehow. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Azon's like, I will make a dish that emphasizes the Satama Jutori's unique deliciousness, and you're going to taste it too, Yukihira, so maybe you'll finally realize just how big the gulf between us is in skill. And Rindo apparently is familiar with what Azon is actually making. So Azon just picks up the chicken and just like, stick it in the pot by hand. That is dangerous to do that. Most people do not do that, I don't think. Just hold it, just, you know, grab it by the edge of the drumsticks and just dip that whole fucking bird in the boiling pot of water. Ugh.
Well, that's the whole the thing about, like, Thanksgiving. It's like a story once per year that someone, like, tried to deep fry their turkey and ends up, like, destroying their house.
Because, yeah, you got to make sure it's outside. You can't do it just in the garage. You've got to have, you know, all this equipment ready. You've got to have this, like two people manipulating this thing that you run through, something that holds on to the turkey and stuff. And Azon's just like, here's a chicken.
Goes in the water splash. I think probably like water's maybe not not nearly as dangerous, but it is still, it's a very interesting
right,
cooking.
Right, because there's no cooking oil and stuff. Yeah. It's not gonna, if it spills out, it's not going to destroy the entire kitchen.
But it is a very interesting method, because I've never heard of this technique before. I've never heard of, like, putting an entire poultry item inside of a boiling thing. I've never heard of boiling a poultry item to begin with, but then, like turning it off very quickly afterwards and being like, right, all right, now just let the residual heat cook it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't cook fucking chicken in a goddamn oven without it coming out dry or shitty. I don't, this dude's magic in my eyes right now.
Right. Yeah, and so all the judges are freaking out. It's like, oh, it's going to be so good. And so I was like, that's an interesting technique. But, you know, my family's restaurant, we never could use a whole bird. You know, it's too expensive. So thanks for teaching me that. Yeah. And he's like, wow, just not phased at all. So he's like, Gadiza is like, now while the bird is boiling, I shall brown the skin and extract the fatty oils from it. And then, in all of that light and delicately rich chicken oil, I'll stir fry some uncooked jasmine rice with garlic and ginger. And so he's just watching the whole time. He's like, I'm just surprised, you can really cook. And he's like, oh. And Rindo starts laughing. So some of the judges are just like, oh, Soba, you are a peasant. You can never become the wizard. No, wait, that's not right.
Did you say the wizard king?
I'm just, nameless people in Shokugeki no Soma making fun of Soma's ignorance. Yeah.
Well, hold on. No, they're like insisting on a Shokugeki. Dur.
I guess there's no point in blaming you for your ignorance. I agree with David Chillington. He's on cooking holiday.
I love that the gimmick from Black Clover has become people shout at Asta, then devolve into random gibberish.
That's what we do whenever someone makes dismissive wanking at the protagonist in any manga now. But Rindo says, I kind of will get what you mean, Soma, because from the outside, Aizen looks like a low-end scheming mob boss. But when it comes down to...
Really? He sounds like Pegasus, though.
But when it comes down to it, he's actually really good. If he hadn't dedicated himself to the consulting side of things from the get-go, by this point in his career, he might have taken down more than one of the current Council of Ten. So, implying that actually he might be better than his ninth C position would imply. Mm-hmm. So maybe some was screwed. The head of the Shokugeki office, while he's watching this on the TV, is like, the list of factors examined in the nomination of new Council of Ten members is extraordinarily wide and varied. Their grades, their performance in events like the cooking camp, their degree of contribution to the institute, each candidate is examined from every possible angle before their seat rank is determined. But the one factor more important than all the others by a wide margin is their Shokugeki record. The amount of money that Aizen earned through consulting in his very first year at Totsuki was easily more than the tuition of every student in his grade combined.
That's an absurd amount. But I'm basing that off the knowledge of what, like, college costs around here.
Well, this
here.
Is a private
school.
Trade school.
That the tuition is very expensive, though.
Right.
Especially for
an elite
school of this caliber.
Right, with an international reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get a bit more of the flashback to Aizen in his younger days, saying, the key, how do I do a baby Aizen? Hang on. The key to profitable consulting is to discover what the client truly wants and then to satisfy that want by at least 110 to 150%. Not just 100%. That's the important bit. Kid, that's impossible. Shut the fuck up. Satisfy their want by 150%. Fuck off.
You're one of those people who's like 110%. Why don't you just tell yourself you're a unicorn while you're at it?
I was like, satisfy them 150%. Just go above and beyond for every single. That makes them seem like super optimistic, doesn't it? Like unrealistically optimistic as opposed to a money grubbing whore. Like, I don't get. What is with that expression? So, Aizen is like, you just have to remember most of your clients aren't going to be specialists in cooking, so just nail what they want on the head and the money will flow in. And so, taking advantage of Totsuki's globe-spanning connections, he has consulted more than 500 projects with different dishes in different fields under different conditions. He has found the perfect answer every time. He never could have accomplished that feat if he didn't have both a natural knack for and a solid familiarity with all the multitude of styles and flavors across the culinary world. With the cleverness to take down his opponents without resorting to a head-on confrontation, he hardly ever participated in a Shokugeki himself. But despite his paltry official record, he was still a unanimous choice for inclusion on the council. The sheer amount of profit he has brought to the Institute is just that massive. He is eminently worthy of the title of the Alchemist. And we get this awesome picture of Aizon dressed up as an old-style alchemist, you know, with a headdress and stuff, and holding a bottle of elixir in one hand and bars of gold gathered by his side and stuff.
It's been too long since we've gotten these. So I'm catching up with the digital manga to kind of get between the parts I read originally and then when it started getting picked up in Weekly Jump. And I'm in the point of the tournament. And there's, like, a series of, like, basically, like, a volume and a half in a row where, like, 10 characters get this sort of introduction where it's,
because,
like,
we gotta, like, hammer it in, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, he is the master of steam, the commander, like, I am the Duke of Salt. I know how to use it more than anyone else. Like, these elaborate declarations to what these cooks, like, have become in their mastery. And there's something so amazing, like, he is the alchemist of cooking.
Well, we got Kiriga saying he's like a lion. We got Tatsuma... Takami? Tatsuma? I forget. Where it was...
Tsukumi? Or...
Tsukumi?
Tsukuya.
I forget. Where was, you know, Der Weiss Ritter Der Tafel.
Yeah, that is right. We did get him as, like, the white knight of the kitchen table.
Right, this is almost an entire chapter dedicated to Aizon is so good, you guys.
It is. It's really kind of crazy, because even I started to wonder. I'm like, this guy really tries to, like, kind of cheat his way around things. Maybe he's not very good at what he's trying to do. Like, you know, maybe he is just more brains than actual talent. And then you get this chapter, like, oh no, he's fucking pimp.
Right.
Like, for what his, like, the way they explain it, like, delivers it so well of, you know, he puts in requests and satisfies them, in his mind, 150% of the time, but for all of these various clients all around the world, and to do that would require an astounding amount of cooking knowledge and cooking ability, because I have to assume many of the times he has to at least practice the dish and show them how to do it first, too.
So right, right.
It's a very interesting way to kind of establish that this guy is a big deal, but there's a reason why he's at the ninth seat, and it's because he's made much of his success outside of the way the school usually ranks its people.
Mm-hmm. So Aizon finishes cooking the chicken. He takes it out, chops off the feet, and puts them back into the water that he was using to boil the chicken, and basically uses parts of the bird to create soup stock from it. And then he starts getting his jasmine rice ready and stuff. And so everyone is like, oh, he's not just steaming it in plain water. He's using some of the water he heated the bird in, which is now a life rock. Moving with the sex of the majority for now, dude, mommy goodness.
Could be faster than the fastest.
Is playing on my... All right, continue. There was like a random fucking advertisement playing on my computer somewhere. I think it was Skype.
Oh.
That was so weird.
I mean, so anyway, the judges are freaking out because, gasp, Aizon used chicken to make chicken stock. I am so amazingly unimpressed by this development. Like, I cannot accentuate, like, oh, what are the council's saying? He made chicken stock from a chicken he was good. Fuck off. Like, this is the most unimpressive thing in the history of Shokugeki no Soma. He used the parts of the bird that he was cooking. Fuck off. I swear. So Aizon, you know, basically is like, oh, this is something a real businessman should never do. But just for you, I'm going to ignore cost. In cooking, strategy is everything. You have no plan, no strategy, no nothing. You challenge me to a Shokugeki, you have no chance of winning. I'm going to make you regret that as you walk out of this institute for the last time. Yeah, someone's got no strategy, mister. I came up with what I was going to do on the fucking spot.
Yeah, he's like, I came into this expecting to do nothing.
So Soma replies by saying, I guess you could say I didn't really have a grand plan going into this, but I didn't challenge you thinking there was no chance. See, with this Shokugeki, there's something that I want to show you, senpai. And he takes off the bandana from around his wrist and ties it around his forehead as he says, honor judges! I'm going to put these pot stickers in to fry and serve them up right now, so I have just another few minutes. And so he starts getting his pot stickers ready, and everyone's like, wait a minute. Those aren't ordinary pot stickers! What a weird sentence.
I love that that's like the dramatic twist for this series.
Those aren't ordinary pot stickers!
I want one time for like the Shokugeki no Soma cliffhanger to get like switched out into another series that's not Toriko's cliffhanger. So like at the end of this week of Bleach, Nanao's like about to get attacked and she's like, wait a minute, those aren't normal pot stickers? Credits.
What did you think of the chapter, Chris?
I loved it. I love seeing Aizen and seeing how he basically was given a lot of build-up in this chapter of explaining, like, he's not a chump. This is actually an extremely talented guy who may even be stronger than you even realize. Like,
right.
The notion that, oh, suddenly, maybe Soma did just jump in way too over his head. Like, even if, you know, it came into the notion that, like, Soma's gonna try in this contest.
Right.
You know. Maybe even if he tries, it might not be enough to beat this guy because he's just actually a better chef as well. It's got me very confused as to how this is going to end because on one hand, I would say, well, Soma has to win. I mean, he hasn't really participated in a very elaborate Shokugeki or anything like that since the tournament ended, and he lost in that one. So he really hasn't had a big Shokugeki win against anyone meaningful in basically like half a year. You know?
Right, there were those guys that he beat, in the when he came back from their training and stuff, but they were all unimportant. The only thing that I would say in terms of like, oh, this can't possibly happen and stuff is Soma cannot be expelled from Totsuki Academy permanently.
Well, the thing is that I feel like even if there is a case where Aizen wins, I feel like it's going to be, I feel like, very similar to the situation with, what was it, Shinomiya? Was that his name? Where he beat, Megumi, but he didn't get her expelled, basically. I forget how exactly, and I forget if it was, like, a tie, or...
Basically, the judges agreed, like, you had the better dish, but Megumi has actually shown greater improvement than you have in the time that you've been teaching here. You've allowed yourself to stagnate as opposed to Megumi in this Shokugeki took a tremendous step forward, and so we want to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
And so Shinomiya, like, acknowledged, okay, yeah, this is actually my loss. So
I feel like a situation could very well happen here where maybe Aizen does win, but what Soma does is so impressive that someone within the hierarchy, maybe it's Azami, maybe he's trying to appeal to Soma, and he basically says, like, oh, hey, I'm going to keep you in the school because you seem like a promising young talent I want in Central. And maybe he's doing it as a way to kind of keep someone Arida is close to in his debt. Or maybe, you know, Rindo does something. Maybe someone does something that basically, or Aizen himself even, impressed that he was forced out into actually giving a fuck in this fight. Maybe he has somewhat of a change of heart. Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've been naming some ideas over the past few weeks. Like, oh, maybe Rindo will do something. Maybe Aizen will be like, I don't actually want to lose the chance to have someone working for me. Who knows?
Yeah, I feel like it could go either way. Neither direction seems like it would be ridiculous to me at this point.
Right, which is so great. Because then you can, you know, it's great to read a manga and not know what's going to happen.
The best wrestling matches are always the ones where you don't know who the winner is going to be. It's always disappointing when you're like, I know ahead of time.
I mean, the best wrestling matches are the ones that Sheamus doesn't walk away champ from. Anyway.
You had that one sitting up for
a
while.
Oh, God, it fucking sucked.
But it is. It's the same thing here, where it's like, not knowing how this is going to go makes it so much more enjoyable, because I know that I'm going to be surprised, or at least unexpecting, of how this comes to an end.
So yeah, that is Food Wars for this
Do you mind if I jump in here real quick? There's something I want to bring up because I heard an offer that I think might interest some of our viewers. So I imagine a lot of you guys out there are subscribers to Weekly Shonen Jump. I know like my subscription's coming up in a little bit. There's an offer that's out there right now. I'm sure a lot of you people have heard of Loot Crate before. It's like the monthly thing you get a bunch of stuff in, like related to some kind of nerd culture thing. There's a new service out called, and I'm going to mispronounce the crap out of it, Omakase. It's O-M-A-K-A-S-S-E.
Omakase.
That is basically going to be like a bi-monthly product, kind of like Loot Crate, but specifically for anime and manga. And Shonen Jump is doing a partnership with them for the next box that's going to be coming out with a Black Friday deal for it. So if you subscribe to get the next box, which is going to be all Naruto stuff. So this is specifically if you're like a big fan of Naruto and you kind of want to get cool Naruto stuff, this is like a good box for it. But with the box, you also get a 6-month subscription to Weekly Shonen Jump. And if you even have a subscription now, it'll basically just add another 6 months then onto your account. So if it's something that you're interested in, if you're like, oh, it sounds like a cool box, I wonder what will be in it. I love Naruto, want that stuff. Check out weeklyshonenjump.com and then sign up for the subscription bundle there, and then that way you get an extra 6 months for it. So I'll post the link here in the chat room. It's a Black Friday deal. It goes active Black Friday, but you can do it now, basically, kind of like pre-subscribe. So something to do if you're interested in, to definitely check out.
Okay, let's move on to My Hero Academia, which pulls a Bleach this week by putting the chapter title on the last page of the chapter. It's number 40, not number 40, number 68, Re-Encounter. Last time, all the practical exams finished up, and also, we, at the very end, we saw a fucking, I swear to God, it is impossible for me to remember this guy's name. This guy's name was said 20 fucking times in this chapter.
Which guy?
Tamura, right? Hand guy.
Shigaraki.
Hand face guy. Shigaraki. I swear, it's impossible for me to remember his name. I will never remember this guy's name.
Hand dude.
Shigaraki basically was just kind of gazing randomly at a picture of Deku, and then Kurogiri showed up with a couple of potential new recruits. And so they're like, you brought the two types I hate most together, a brat and a guy with no manners. Whatever. So they introduce themselves. The girl is Himiko Toga, who introduces herself by saying, "Life is too hard. I want to make a world that's easier to live in. I want to be Mr. Staney. I want to kill Mr. Staney. So let me join you." Oh, you're a little creepy, aren't you? Yeah. And the scarred up guy says, "You know, I don't know about this. Are you guys really dedicated to the cause?" And Shigaraki's like, "Hey, at least freak girl here can say her own name, so... you know, if you're a proper adult, you try doing that." And he just says, "I go by Dobby." "No, tell me your real name. You'll know it when you need to." So he is getting a proper look at his face. He actually has a design that I quite like. It looks like a lot of his body has sort of been sewn on. I don't think that is exactly what's happened, but like basically he's got all these piercings or staples or something on that attach the good parts of his flesh to the bad parts. Mm-hmm. So it seems as though he's had basically really, really bad skin grafts. And he says that he wants to make the hero killer's will a reality. So Shirai is like, "Oh God, you guys are on about stain. He starts to hold out his hands and Kurogiri is like, "Don't do it." And he's like, "I'm in a bad mood. You guys are no good." And he starts to reach his hands out towards them. He has to, like, summon a bunch of portals, Kurogiri does, in order to prevent them all from attacking each other. So all their hands go out these different portals and they don't end up touching each other and stuff. And he's like, "Come on, If we want to actually accomplish your goals, then we've got to expand your organization. We've got to get in your groups and stuff. And this is, you know, our big chance. You know, we're in the spotlight right now, so we should accept these people instead of reject them. And he starts whispering in Shigaraki's ear and saying, acceptance of anything we can use of whatever remains of his will. So he's just like, you know, we don't have to agree with everything that's going on here, but come on, this is a big chance. Let's use these guys. Be smart, you idiot.
It's interesting to me. Or maybe not interesting. Concerning. I'm very confused as to why Shigaraki seems to really dislike everybody that gets offered to be a part of his villain group. Like, he's not the leader, I assume, right?
No, he's an important figure, but the guy with All for One is the leader.
Yeah. So every person, because both these people, and he hated Stain too, he didn't want Stain to work with him either. I'm getting like this impression he's just like a really picky person, but it's also crossing into that small area where I'm like, oh, we have an idiot as like the main villain.
He seems very bratty.
Yeah, yeah, like it's like, oh, like I always like when it seems like the villains are competent, and he is, you know, he's not necessarily proven himself to be incompetent or anything like that, but I don't know, I guess I almost am looking for a reason why he's being very picky and bratty towards most of these people. Because he doesn't even wait for them to say anything. The first moment he sees him is like, oh, brat dude who fucking annoys me. Like, mm-hmm. This is great. Maybe it's just because he reminds me of Infamous Planet. Maybe that's it.
Oh, new people want to join the organization.
These ones going bald to me.
Oh, you're a little kid. I hate children.
Oh, you're the worst of both worlds. You're a child, but you're also a woman, which means that we can have babies, and I'd have to be responsible.
You're like a child that can make more children. No. Anyway, we cut to the academy, where the people who failed the practical exam are looking very gloomy. And he's like, oh, you hope you guys enjoy the trip. You're bringing us awesome stories and stuff. And Deku's like, hey, maybe there's some sort of twist. Maybe you'll get to join us. And he's like, you're going to jinx it, Midoriya. Shut up. And Kaminari, like, it's like, failure exams means summer school instead of camping in the woods. And he sticks his hand down into Deku's face and actually pokes him in the fucking eye. It's like, geez, dude, chill.
He just wants him to know. He's really bummed.
Yeah. And actually, Sarah speaks up by saying, he's like, you know, I don't know. I don't think I did very well either because, I mean, I only passed because Mineta did all the work. So, I mean, we're agreeing on actual performance as opposed to purely results. You know? And they're like, shut up! I don't want your pity, Sarah!
I always forget which one Sarah is, too. He's the tape guy.
Yeah, okay. Aizawa enters and he says, all right, guys, get seated. Okay. We had some failures in the final exams. But you're all going to the summer training camp! And everyone's like, oh, what a twist! And I was like, okay, I mean, everyone passed the written test. Well, good job, everybody. But Kirishima, Kaminari, Ashido, Sato, and Sero all failed. So, yeah, Sero's like, oh, man, I knew clearing the practical didn't necessarily mean that I passed. Oh, it's even more embarrassing than if I had actually failed outright. And Aizawa explains, look, we came up with assignments suited for all of you, ones that would give you chances to devise winning strategies. And if we hadn't, none of you would have stood a chance. So, yeah, it was a chance, you know, where, you know, you would have a chance to push yourselves forward and stuff. But, you know, we're talking about training camp. More than anyone else, those who failed are in dire need of this. This was another rational deception. That's a great phrase, rational deception. I love that. And everyone's just like, what the fuck do you mean, rational deception? But anyway, they're all celebrating and stuff. Because like, oh, we get to go and stuff. And he is like, oh, man, we've been fooled again. I would expect nothing less from UA. But now that you've lied to us twice, aren't you worried that our faith in you has been shaken? And he's like standing up and raising his hand and stuff. And Uraraka's like, stop being such a wet blanket.
You're like, stop being such a fucking doof.
You fucking suck up, class president. And Aizawa says, well, you know, this wasn't technically a lie, because, you know, failure is still failure, so you guys are going to receive special supplemental lessons. And to be honest, they'll be worse than summer school. Anyway, I'm going to hand out camp manuals, so enjoy yourselves!
Bye!
So, yeah, and they're they have this, like, camp manual so that they know what kind of supplies they need and stuff, and I forget the Invisible Girl's name, but she's like, oh, you know, we've got, you know, off tomorrow, tests are over, we should all go shopping together and get supplies and stuff. And so Kamiya was like, yeah, that's a great idea. And Kirishu was like, yeah, come on, Bakugo, let's go. And Bakugo's like, that's a waste of time, not going. And Deku's like, hey, Todoroki, do you want to go? And Todoroki's like, I have someone I visit on my days off. Oh, he goes to see his mom.
But it's like cuts away to him tomorrow, and it's just him at a strip club.
Well, Minato is like you know, listening to all these, and he says, "Come on, guys, try reading the fucking mood once in a while."
Yeah, I do like that notion that it's like two Billy Bob going, "I don't want to go," and then laying like, "I visit people." It's like, we're in a fucking moment. Are you guys ever not on?
The girls want to go have fun with us.
The girls want to go try on fucking bikinis. Can you shut up and just go? You two are the most popular fuckers in class.
They're not going to let me judge the bikinis they're going to model unless you're there too. Yayorozu took her top off in front of you, Todoroki. Come on, be my wingman on this. So... everyone goes to the mall, and actually, I like that, you know, everyone just kind of showed up in casual attire for once, because usually we see them in their superhero uniforms, or they're in their school uniforms, so everyone's looking a little different for once. And not everyone has gone along. From what it looks like eight of them have gone on this trip, so...
because we see more of them who aren't in that first shot. Like,
We see the forearmed guy.
And forearmed guy.
Right. But, yeah, we got, you know, the main three are there, and Mineta's there, what's her name? Ashido? Ashido's there, and so on. So, a good number of them have gone, Invisible Girl included, which is, of course she doesn't show up in the group shot, she's the fucking Invisible Girl. I like how there's just a shirt floating around.
The concerning thing is it doesn't look like it's wearing pants.
No. So, you know, they're discussing what kind of stuff they need. It's like, oh, I need a bag, I need to get this, I need to get that, and so on and so forth. And it's like, where do you think they sell lock-picking equipment and hand drills?
That's way too sophisticated of a voice for that character. He's just like, where do you think they sell lock-picking equipment and hand drills?
No. That's too much of a loser. We gotta find a good pervert voice. Hang on. Where do you think they sell lock-picking equipment and hand drills?
That was like the Joker.
Hand drills. Going to peek on the girls, Harley. We've sent us suggestions for what voice Minetta should have, everybody. It's got to be appropriate because he has some of the best lines in this series, and I love reading them.
All right, pervert. Should he sound like Bill Cosby?
Oh, no.
Where do you think they sell lock-picking equipment and hand drills?
I'm still open, Papa. No, we're not doing that. So everyone kind of runs off in different directions and stuff, and Deku is like, oh, Uraraka, where do you need to get? I mean, I'm looking for heavy wrist weights, and Uraraka says, oh, I think I need bug spray, and suddenly she remembers what Ayama says, like, oh, you like him, and so she goes, bug spray, and she runs away. So Deku is left on his own. And he is suddenly approached by a mysterious man in a black hoodie. He's like, oh, hey, can I have your autograph? You're that kid from the sports festival who got wrecked and stuff. And Deku's like, yeah, I am. Why are you hugging me and stuff? He's like, I guess people still recognize me and stuff. And, oh, yeah, and then you ran to that hero killer I saw on the news and stuff. I can't believe we'd meet here again. And Deku's like, wait, what do you mean? And he suddenly realized, wait, it's that uncanny presence. I can't help but think that something special has helped you come this far. Something like fate or destiny, maybe. And he like grabs Deku around the neck. Well, I guess for you, we last met in that attack on UA. Let's get some tea and chat, Izuku Midoriya. He looks even creepier without the hand on his face.
It took me a moment to actually realize who it was. And then I'm like, oh, that's actually very disturbing. I don't know. It's not a, like, strange face. It seems like there's a little bit of maybe, like, dryness around the lips, like, almost cracked or, like,
something. Well, no, his eyes look a little bit that way, too.
Yeah. But it's... it's not like a terrifying face, but it's something about the fact that it's always been concealed by a floating fucking hand before, and now it's not. It's just like, ooh, this is unnerving.
Yeah, he's seen his uncovered eyes, and their veins are bulging in them, and he looks like he's dying of thirst, basically, from how shriveled up the area around his eyes and lips are.
Yeah, it's a very disturbing appearance.
Plus, just showing up in the middle of a fucking mall and sneaking up on Deku, and it's like, yeah, I can kill you right now. So
yeah. Now, Nick, how did you feel about this chapter?
It happened.
As of right now, it's currently winning in the poll, in the chat poll for this week.
I guess people really like the reveal at the end. I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of just like waiting, for like the important stuff to happen next chapter, basically. It's a good cliffhanger to leave off on, but other than that, I mean, it's just kind of like, oh, the kids are hanging out and stuff, and it's, a few little fun things, but compared to all the awesome stuff that was happening during the test and stuff, this is, definitely not my favorite chapter of the week.
I mean, there's definitely cool parts to it, and I think the ending is exciting, but I definitely am, in the same camp, I think, as a lot of other people, where I'm like, it's an okay chapter, it's, I think it's, the fact that I'm still not crazy on board with Shigaraki, where I just kind of think it's a little bit annoying, but...
If he shown up out of the blue, instead of spending the first part of the chapter whining, he would have been more effective. I liked it all right, though.
Yeah, it was quite fine.
I want to talk a bit about Nisekoi?
Yeah, sure, if you want to talk about Nisekoi.
This is the full-on wrap-up of the story arc that they had. Mariko was rescued from her for wedding, and then when she got away, her mother finally agreed to let her do what she wanted, which means that she can go to America to get the treatment she needs to cure her illness and still be allowed to do what she wants with her life, and as opposed to getting married off to someone that she doesn't love. So this is the send-off, everyone in the airport, wishing her well, and like, Onodera's crying, and Ruri's like, I'll send you books so that you won't get bored in the hospital, you have something to read. So, nice sentiments and stuff. Chitoge, that's kind of how you would expect. He was like, we're finally got some peace and quiet around here. Come on, everyone, let's go. Come on, everybody, let's leave Raku. She's like, come on, everybody, let's go to the souvenir shop I want to check out. And Raku's like, okay, I'll come too. You stay here! I was like, come on. Yeah. Even, her love rival, she's like, you guys deserve some time alone stuff. So, good move on you. So, Marika's, says some very important things in this chapter, because she says, you're going to confess to Onodera? I know you've got a crush on him. On her. That's the twist of the series. Raku was gay the whole time.
He's like, I've always been into you, Shu.
So, yeah, Marika's like, I know you actually have a crush on Onodera. I know your relationship with Chitoge is fake, but I also know that you're harboring feelings for her. And this is probably the most important part of the chapter, actually, is the fact that Marika is finally forces it into Raku's head that he probably is into Chitoge, and everything kind of comes back to him, the conversations he's had over the last couple of story arcs where, Shu was like, hey, do you like Onodera Kiyosaki? And then when he freaked out imagining Chitoge when he was having an encounter with Yui and stuff, and so he claims like, I don't really have any special feelings for her, and Mark is like, I know that you do. I mean, I can tell, basically. Because, I've observed you so closely for a while, I can see how you look at Onodera, and I can see how you look at Chitoge. And when she's talking about this, she gets a little bit like, I see the way you look at Onodera, fuck her. But she's like, you like both of them. And, you're going to have to acknowledge that, and you're going to have to make a decision. And then she wraps it all up with, and if you don't, then when I come back 2 years from now, I'm going to have no choice but to make you mine for real, because I'm not giving up now. And it's like, that's good on her.
She's not giving up, even though she is.
Well, yeah, I mean, she's going away. She is actually leaving the series, presumably for a while, if not until the last chapter or whatever. Because, she's going to show up again at some point. And at least
next chapter, she's dead. You're like, wow, this got dark.
For the time being, it seems like, hey, took the most popular character in the series and seemingly actually...
Let's... let's put that into some perspective. It's the most she's the most popular character because one dude really, really likes her. Otherwise, she'd probably be like third or fourth.
What do you mean?
Because the only reason that Marika ever wins the popularity polls is because there's one dude who sends in thousands of postcards.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not hear that.
Yeah, no, it's like one dude, I forget his name in Japan, but he's done it for Y-Sand, apparently people are saying. Yeah, he's done it for, like, all the popularity and, like, the date contests and stuff like
that.
Yeah, just one dude sends in, I think it's like thousands of postcards, essentially, because he really likes Marika. And that's why she keeps winning them all.
That's really creepy. Okay.
It's endearing, little sad.
Sister fetishes and rigged popularity contest. Japan knows how to do creepy stuff. Jeez. So, well, she is still a popular character, though. And, you know, putting her on a bus like this is... I was actually surprised that they are seemingly carrying on actually shipping her away, even if the series is supposedly going to end relatively soon. So Marika, you know, basically leaves in that note and also says, oh, Raku, you know, your hair is messed up in the front. Let me fix it for you. And Raku's like, oh, really? And he leans forward and she grabs him by the head and kisses him on the forehead. Stuck one in there. Good on you, Marika. And then she just immediately leaves as Raku's like, that devil papa girl kissed her. Marika has a little conversation with Honda as they're on their way to the gate. And they have this little heart to heart where they, you know, because they understand each other better now, when Marika's like, hey, what's your real name and stuff? And she says, it's Yoko. And then she's like, okay, well, with that out of the way, check this out. It's my plan for self-improvement regime in the hospital. I'm going to be the ultimate lady by the time I get back. So, taking this whole thing seriously and stuff. And then on one final note, she looks out the window of the plane and sees, basically back inside the airport, everyone and their group of friends, aside from Raku, are carrying these signs to spell out, come home to us. And Chitake is crying. Aww. So, that was a pretty good chapter, actually. Quite liked it.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting that we really did get a long arc out of Nisekoi. This was essentially 3 months worth of storyline. Maybe even longer than that if you count build up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was enjoyable. We got cool fight scenes out of it. We got some exciting dramatic moments. It was enjoyable all around.
Yeah.
So.
And important developments as well. It was like, hey, Raku, one of your competing love interests is gone, and she spelled out you like the other two. So fucking get to it.
It is like, what, like the fourth person now who's been like, hey, Raku, do you have a thing for Chitoge or not? And it's like, what?
And so maybe finally this one will stick. Who knows?
Yeah. Shall see. I have just found out that Fairy Tail has gone up, so I can go through it. It would be a live reading? It would be a live reading.
Okay.
So
all right.
Before I begin that, though, I just want to comment on this. It's not like Crunchyroll isn't putting it out, though it is out there if you want to see it. There is a special chapter, basically 362.5, which is a holiday chapter.
Yeah.
It is. If you thought Fairy Tail was shameless in its and weird in its fan service, it reaches an extreme I cannot tell you.
Words cannot do it justice. It must be seen to be believed. Because it's not just like Wendy and Wendy's not in it. But
no, Wendy is in it.
She is?
Wendy is in it. She is made to dress up in a maid uniform and bow like a puppy dog, which is creepy.
Well, it's not just, you know, Wendy and Lucy and Urza and Juvia dressing up in their underwear, or I think at the end, I think it ends with Urza being made to walk home naked.
And basically, it
is also.
Just to explain it, it is basically the main principal cast of Fairy Tail, including all the male characters, go to a Christmas party, all of the female characters get very drunk, and the chapter ends with essentially everyone either naked or about as close to naked as they can be, and that's... And then it tries to end on a sweet moment. It's so weird.
The whole idea is that Urza is jealous because all of the ship teases are present except hers. Mm-hmm. And so basically because Lucy and everybody and Juvia and everybody are drunk, they kind of pair off a little bit more than usual with their love interest. And so she's like, everybody's got someone to be lovey-dovey with except me. And so she basically makes them play Truth or Dare.
It's not true. It's
the king game.
Kings, yeah. Basically, whoever wins it gets to tell two other people what to do or tell another person what to do. And it basically just evolves to, you take your clothes off. You take your clothes off. You throw your underwear out the window. You go buy things down at the store in your underwear. You get hot wax poured down your back and get really erotic. It's weird as fuck. I can't
not
describe it.
Not so spank-a-geal.
But it is ridiculous. So if you want to enjoy that, it is out there. We're not going to be covering that on this chapter or this episode. So be aware that is out there. Not what we're doing right now, though. This is Fairy Tail chapter 463, Black Carpet, which after that prior description sounds a lot more pornographic of a title than I wanted it to be. But I'm going to assume this is an innocent chapter because it has an innocent opening. It's just Leon and Gray and Luvia in the snow hanging out. I think Gray's talking, so, you know, nothing suggestive there at all. All right, so
go to the next page, just Juvia imagining Gray and Leon making out.
I'm like, well, that was fortuitous, I suppose. So hold on, I'm gonna try to read this, not verbatim, because I know that might take up some time. But it looks like everyone's reacting to the fact that Natsu flew off. That's where we left last time. Natsu flew off, and he's going to go fight Xerath. A couple members of the guild want to go after him, but Urza says, we will adhere to the First Master's plan. We will leave Xerath to Natsu. Gray's like, are you serious? He's up against Xerath, you know? And Xerath has the Book of End. Natsu said something about having a plan to defeat Xerath. I have every confidence he will. Wow, Gray gets really intense here. You always put way too much trust in Natsu, Urza. What a very un-fairy tale-like thing to say.
Yeah, really. Don't trust in your friends, or is it? Come on.
Yeah, what has friendship ever gotten you? does that mean you do not trust him? And Gray's like, It was like a weird, like, bleach line there. You don't honestly believe Urza or Natsu would be like that. I guess you don't.
Gray, you shouldn't say things about people that you don't believe.
Yeah, smile, look out in the sunset. I'm trying to think who's actually saying this. Oh, it looks like it's Mavis saying it. It may seem like a reckless charge, but it's possible he actually has a logical strategy. We are hemmed in on all four sides, so an attack on their supreme commander may end things before he has a chance to box us in completely. It could be an excellent plan. Let's trust Natsu. And maybe Gray, it seems like Gray's actually just very worried about Natsu, and maybe that's why he's kind of lashing out, because he says, I just don't want him going off alone. And Charlie's like, he isn't alone. Happy's with him, right? And I'm like, all right, Happy's a thing in this series. I forget that there are cats that are friends with them at points. Natsu is flying above a big group of their army. He says, I'm all burned up. Oh, no, he says, I burned it up, huh? Oh, because he burned everybody up with his big fire attack before. Right. And he basically flies through their army and batters them. That was a little anticlimactic. Oh, I guess there's a lot more to the army, apparently.
It is a cool picture when he first engages the army, because he basically, you know, swoops in on this, like, bombing run. And he is shooting flames from either hand, so it looks like he's, like, summoning these wings out, wings of fire. It's a cool-looking picture.
Yeah, I enjoy it. Everyone's like, what is it? It's an enemy attack! And, you know, Belantia's like, I'm gonna take all of them down, because that's how I'm gonna draw Xerath out. So he's basically just bashing everybody. He's using his fire techniques and just, you know, exploding people, launching all the army guys away, knocking their attacks to the side. Just completely one-shotting these guys. Does his fire dragon king's roar. I always appreciate that Crunchyroll puts the, like, translation of their names in, like, the tiniest font in the bottom corner. Oh, and he even changes the landscape. Everyone's like, he's a monster. They never told us there was anybody there was anybody with this kind of power in Ishkul. How many men would she take it down anyways? 973. Leaving 999,027. As Xerath shows up.
Man, Xeriflex, big round numbers for his army, doesn't he?
He does. He's like...
Cool million.
It has to be a million exactly.
Sir, we've recruited 1,000,005 soldiers to our army. Kill five of them.
Yeah, murder the five smallest. We are not marching in with an odd number.
Well, we could get one more person, then we'd be 1,000,006.
All right, you're one of the five we're killing.
Natsu says, you got here quicker than I expected. He's like, I was just eager to say hi, Natsu. But now's the time to say bye, Xerif. That's a lame line. But what are you going to do? That's the way the chapter ends.
He's not known for his one-liners, so...
Yeah,
and he's unwrapping the bandage around his arm, so he's getting his special plan ready.
That is true. He did note he had something to do with his arm. So it seems the Natsu-Xerif confrontation is, in fact, going to happen. And it's going to happen next week! Dragon Ball Z.
I can't imagine this working out very well for Natsu.
I hope it does, and it's because here I've been playing Tales of Zestiria recently, and there's a point in the game. I don't know if you play many RPGs, but a lot of them, like when you walk around the world, the enemy mobs will be walking around too, and if you run into them, you'll start a battle with them. In Tales of Zestiria is the only time I've ever seen this happen. You can walk into an area, and the fucking boss of the game is walking around like one of those mobs, and you can just engage him. And he's like 50 levels higher than you're possibly going to be at that point. But I want to know if you grind all the way, like you just spend days upon days fighting fucking skunks to get to level 90 or whatever, if you fight him there and beat him, if it just spontaneously ends the game.
Some games, you know, have that thing where it's supposed to be like an unwinnable battle, and then... the first enemy you encounter in Super Metroid is Ridley, and you don't have all your awesome weapons and stuff, so there's no way you can possibly win. But if you manage to actually deal a certain amount of damage to him before you hit a dangerous health level, which is when he flies away, he'll still fly off. So either he takes enough damage or you take enough damage. You know, you're not going to die, and he's not going to die. They programmed it both ways. But in some cases, they don't actually think of that. They're just like, well, there's no way that the character will possibly be this high level. And then you, like, you know, get your fucking Game Shark or whatever open and be like, I am now level 200 on a 100-point scale. And
Game Shark. Nick, when's the last time you played a video game?
1997.
Oh, okay.
All those times we played Left 4 Dead together? No, it wasn't actually me.
It's actually been you using a proxy.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, so maybe Natsu will just end the plot all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's just like, it's like Hiro, like, finishes the chapter. He's like, I didn't expect that to happen. I just ended it abruptly. Whoops. Oh, well, send it out to print. I've got more spin-off magazines to write. I want one where Elfman is a delivery man. He has another fucking series out, too, I think.
Really? God.
I forget what it is. There's another spinoff of someone else within Fairy Tales universe.
Oh, okay. I thought you said he was, like, starting up an entire
new
series.
No, not another series, but there's another spinoff.
Another spinoff is not too surprising.
Yeah.
Let's do One Piece, chapter 807, 10 days earlier. And I guess we haven't really noticed this the last couple of times we've... There is, like, one of those kind of cover page things going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure exactly what's going on here.
It
seems as though a whole bunch of students at Zoro's old academy are imitating him, though.
Yeah, well, the whole gimmick to this cover page thing is they're going around kind of showing how the world is reacting to the fact that all the Straw Hat's bounties have been raised. So last time we saw, it was all the people back on Fuchsia Island reacting to it at Mako's Bar, I believe is the name of the bartender there.
It wasn't Vivi the first one, I think?
No, the first one was just, a news coup flying out. The first one was in Luffy's hometown.
I must be thinking of a different cover.
You might have seen Mako and think it was Vivi, because women in One Piece pretty much look alike. This is one showing what's happened. This is Zoro's school reacting to it and showing that in lieu of Zoro's feats, everyone in the school is now practicing his three sword style, and his teacher looks to be quite exasperated by that.
I like how some of the teachers are like, ah, ha, ha, that Zoro, and the main one's just like, God damn it.
But it's kind of cool seeing him again, and I'm excited to see where this little story cover page arc goes, because I would like to see where all the different people are like, mm-hmm. after the time skip, because I think the last time we saw them was basically after Water 7 when everybody got their bounties.
Mm. So pretty much all the Straw Hats are now in this village on Zo. So most of the crew is reunited except for Sanji. Brooke ends up coming in and saying, like, oh, everyone, you're here. I'm so relieved, and so on and so forth. And, Luffy's like, oh, hey, Brooke, you look like a mess. And it's like, oh, I'm just sorry about Sanji. I'm afraid I've lost all face now that I have one. Skull joke. Yeah. And also, Usopp's like, so where's Momonosuke? I mean, you know, and Brooke says, oh, well, he doesn't get along with the minks. He's locked himself in his room and won't come out, which actually works to our advantage. And so he kind of gets all the Straw Hats in this group huddle, and they kind of exchange information. They're like, okay, where's Kinemon? He should be here soon, and so on and so forth. And Brooke explains, look, I mean, don't mention Samurai while you're here. Don't mention Wano when you're here. There is some sort of hatred that these people bear for that, which presumably is why Momonosuke is, confining himself to his room, is because they keep on bad-mouthing his father and his people.
So. It's interesting, though, because I was kind of wondering what this arc's going to be, and I wonder if this is going to be basically kind of like the prelude arc into Wano, because we know they're eventually going to go to Wano. That's, where Kinemon and Mononosuke's from. And you have to assume Zoro's going to want to go to the Island of Samurai at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of wondering if maybe this arc will be a shorter one, maybe only like a year or so long, that'll kind of build up to maybe something bigger happening in Wano.
Mm-hmm. So, Brooke doesn't get the chance to explain why they don't like Samurai before some of the minks come around and are like, oh, Baron Corpse, you're here! And they all remember when, I always forget this one's name. Uh-huh. She was like, oh, your dead friend is there. And they're like, oh, because Brooke Blitz is technically dead. Right. Okay. Yeah. So basically, I guess they're like, oh, so one of our friends has not been killed. All right, great. And she's like, well, we meant, dead friend as a term of endearment. Also, all the minks love the fuck out of Brooke because they like to chew on his bones.
Well, also, because I know some people have been like, oh, these guys kind of almost just feel like Zoan fruits or something like that. But do you know the fact that these guys actually are more like animals?
They're more like animals.
Like, they just can't stop licking and fucking, gnawing on Zoro. Like, they're just annoying like animals are at times. Like, I want attention.
Right.
Let us nibble on you. Let us lick you.
Stop chewing on my arm!
Well, there's one that says, let us garch you. I don't know what garch you is. I'm not sure what that means. It's at the bottom of the two-page spread, the bottom right-hand corner of it. It's like the animals yelling at Zoro, and one says, come on, let us nibble you. Another says, come on, or let us lick you. And then the last one says, let us, and it's one word, garch you.
Let us garch you. Yeah. I have no idea. Oh, well. So, Nami brings up, what are we going to do about Sanji? Now, we still don't know what happened to Sanji.
Yes.
Apparently, Luffy's group has been told what happened to him.
Now, that One Piece was off last week. And the week before that ended with Nami crying and hugging Luffy and saying, it's Sanji, mm-hmm. in reference to where is Sanji. So, indicating something bad happened. This one picks up. You have not missed anything unless, an extra side chapter was released or something like that. So, it seems as though the Straw Hats have been told what happened to Sanji.
And the audience is not.
We have not been told yet. So I assume it's supposed to still be a humorous surprise for us or something like that. Because the Straw Hats, Luffy and Zoro don't seem to be like...
Right. Zoro says, well, you have the letter thing. It'll work out. And Luffy's like, yeah, it's not like he's been abducted. And I was like, come on, take this seriously. And Chopper's like, we couldn't do anything to save him. And Franky says, we're in a state of confusion. I don't really know what's going on here.
And it's basically just him being like, yeah, I'm the audience at this point.
And Usopp's happening. And Usopp says, we thought the minks were our enemies, but now we're being welcomed here. We're labeled the companions of their saviors. And Robin says, can you explain everything from the last 11 days? What happened? So Nami's like, okay, let's do that. And she picks up with the last transmission between the Straw Hats, where they were being chased by Big Mom, the Big Mom Pirate's giant singing ship, singing shippy, shippy, and,
I like that the ship itself literally sings, shippy, and then later shippy. Reacts to things.
Oh, no!
Oh, it should have the voice of Mr. Bill.
So they're like, oh yeah, you know, the two members that we of her crew we met at Fishman Island were there, as well as another member of the worst generation, Capone Gang, Beige.
I don't know if it's Beige or BG or Beige.
Beige.
I think it's Beige, but I'm not sure. I call him Capone.
But Capone, his group has affiliated themselves with Big Mom, apparently. Dun, dun, dun.
That actually is interesting. I was kind of wondering how these supernovas would eventually all kind of shake out. So we know that... I think I also heard that Drake is with Kaido. And we know that Scratch Manapu, Hawkins, and Kid are kind of formed their own alliance.
Right. And, so. Of course, Law is working together with Luffy and Zoro, for that matter.
Yeah.
And Bonnie's off on her own, trying to survive day to day, basically.
Yeah, not sure what she's up to. And then we know that Roge is up in the kingdom, up in the sky, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think if there's anyone else I'm missing in that. Killers with Kid's crew. I think that's all of them. I think so.
So, Brooke, basically, they tried to use the coup de burst on the Sunny to try and get away, but Brooke was like, oh, let's use that. And we're like, we don't know how to use that without Frankie Arusa up here. And so, I mean, like, the only option they had was like, oh, Chopper is saying, like, oh, we could use the Gown Cannon. And Sunny said, there is no way we can win head on. So, well, we'll fight from the stern and create a chance to break free. And so they fought back and forth. We get, you know, a few little highlights, I guess, of what was going on. And, essentially, what happened was Brooke and Chopper worked together to neutralize some cannonballs that were being fired at them, catch them, and then set them up for Sanji to kick back, which caused, their ship to go, oh no!
I fucking love this. I love the notion that, Brooke freezes all of them, then Chopper just uses Caesar like a fucking parachute.
I didn't realize he was grabbing
it. Yeah, he uses him as the basic, like, the parachute to grab all the cannonballs, then launches them and Caesar into it, and Sanji kicks them through Caesar. I'm assuming that's also why they kind of explode forward a little bit, because of gas with Sanji's fire leg. Right. It just makes me laugh that they used him as a fucking, like, a net to catch all the cannonballs in.
Right. So we get.
That's the other thing, though. We don't know where Caesar is. I don't know.
Yeah. It might be an important detail. Maybe they lost Caesar Clown. And then Nami kind of basically covered their escape by manipulating the weather and stuff, which gets a little round of applause from the Straw Hats. Oh, good job! Yeah. And of course, Nami is like, "Oh, it's shucks." And Chopper is like, "Oh, shut up! I'm not embarrassed."
I love that Nami takes all the credit for it, having done the least stuff.
Oh, man, the credit's all mine. Yeah,
it's like you put the cover away. You didn't actually fight them, though.
and the Minks say that, like, actually, you know, it's great that Nami's group landed here that day. I mean, it was nothing short of a miracle, because without them, every last Mink in Mokomoa Dukedom could have died without hope. Their Duke apparently has been unconscious for a while, and he's just awakened, and Chopper seemingly has been caring for him, which everyone is very grateful for. And Chopper's got, like, a couple of Minks that I guess are sort of his students now, maybe. Or maybe they're the doctors around here, and Chopper is just
I think the doctors on the island, but they're like, you are a much better animal doctor than we are.
And Dr. Miyagi is a goat, and he's like, oh boy, I've goat to see this. Shut the fuck
up. I hate puns, but there's something so amusing about a god-awful pun of that magnitude.
I've goat to see this.
Like, so forced. Like, he feels like a guy who just has to say got a lot so he can put that in, like, oh, what are you going to see? Well, I'm definitely
goat
to see Hunger Games this weekend. Like, you fucking... The tense was not the way you were going with that originally. You forced that one in.
And we've got,
well, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I'm going to fucking kill you.
They also get word from Duke Doggypine that he a message for Wanda, who is the main dog of Mink that we've seen so far, that he wants to meet with the Saviors. And he's like, oh, I'm so glad that she's like, I'm so glad that he's okay. And so she starts to escort them, but they're like, who the hell is Doggypine? She says, he is the Duke of Mokomo Dukedom, the king of this land since the fall of the city, and he's been in a deep coma. The land has two kings, the king of the day, Duke Doggypine, and the king of the night, a cat viper. And we cover to Whale Forest, where Law has come across his crew, and they're reunited with them. And they're like, oh, you came for us! Oh, yay, we've got so much to catch up on, come with us, and so on. So, I like Law's crew likes him. Then we cut back to the village, and Wanda's explaining half a month ago, 17 days ago, for the first time in a month and a half since the arrival of Beppo's group, Mokomo Dukedom's visitor's bell rang, but it was not the welcoming bell. It was a bell that is never meant to ring. The raiding bell! The enemy cut through the forest and invaded this peaceful city. The tremendous rumbling caused Zunesha to trumpet. And let me ask Yutea this. If a vicious enemy wanted something that we do not have, how should we give it to them? And so, basically, I guess there was another elephant on top of the elephant?
Yeah, it seems like maybe... I've heard some people are suggesting maybe it's an ancient Zoan, a mammoth Zoan. Because we have seen elephant Zoan before, way back in the day. It was a... Funkfried, which was Spandam's sword way back in Water 7 in the Aeneas Lobby. But if it is, I mean, an ancient Zoan mammoth actually would be kind of cool, because it is hairy, so it would make sense for it to be a mammoth.
Right.
And it could be an interesting development.
And seemingly someone personally the mammoth, if not maybe the mammoth itself, who knows, it's One Piece, demanded that the people of the village hand over a warrior from Wano known as Rizo, who he says is supposed to be here. And that's where the chapter ends. So, more like a very slow explanation of stuff going on in One Piece. A couple of good tidbits here and there. I like the brief little fight thing that we got between the Big Mom pirates and the B team of the Straw Hats. But
I like that it was also like a showcase of Sanji being like a very capable captain. Like, mm-hmm. Staying there and recognizing, like, it's, we're not going to get anywhere if we turn around and try to fight this. Let's come up with a plan to try to delay them, kind of take any action. It was a cool combo attack. Like, it's one of the funnest parts of One Piece is that when they need to generally stop something that's a big threat, they'll work together to do it. And I always like to see these big kind of team attacks. Like, just the notion of, like, I'll freeze the cannibals, you catch them and throw them into the other, and Sanji will kick them forward. Like, it's just, like, a cool dynamic to see the whole group kind of working together to take down some. So I like that aspect. I am a little concerned and confused at the way the Sanji aspect is being handled right now. The fact that the characters seem to know, but we don't. But they don't feel like it's a big deal. So I feel like I don't feel like it's a big deal. But at the same time, like, it's been like a fucking year and a half without Sanji. You bring him back. It's still an enjoyable chapter. I liked it more than I was bothered by anything. So.
Mm-hmm. It's good. It was pretty all right. Let's wrap things up with Toriko, because there is no World Trigger chapter this week, unfortunately.
Bummer.
Yeah. Toriko, basically, in Gourmet 348, there's nothing that can't be eaten. Essentially, preparations are done, and everybody is going to... Don Slime is going to lead all the crew of chefs and stuff, Komatsu included, into... the food spirits they're going to the spirit world so that they can get the food spirits kitchen. It's actually really weird because everyone is in full, like, they've made all of the golden cooking tools for everybody, so there's just this meant to be badass lineup of all the chefs standing there in shining chef's hats and aprons, and it's like, god, this series is weird.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I don't know why I just like always thought when they, like, were making a big deal about these, like, all these different cooking items, for some reason, I was like, well, clearly it'll be like one for each, but I was like,
that,
oh,
was, the,
like,
that was the impression I got too.
They're like
no.
mass producing these things.
It's like, yeah, well, that sure makes them seem super valuable and important if, like, they make 20 of all of them.
Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, the first half of the chapter is basically a continuation of the stuff that we've seen in the last few chapters with, you know, everybody helping to prepare stuff. All of the gourmet knights have come back from their journey looking super exhausted and stuff, but they managed to get all the materials that they need for everything. And then Kuribo manages to just use the materials to create their cookware by hand. That's scary. He's actually a very scary-looking guy without any all of his pots on, too, because you realize how small his head is in comparison to the rest of his body. Ugh. And also we get Melk the Second sharpening stuff and creating everything. Or,
it's, knives, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting because they still think that Melk is a guy. Melk the Second's a girl, remember?
Yeah. Well, it's tough to remember. There's like two female characters in this series.
That's why I remember it. and that's pretty much it that happens. They make all the items and stuff, and then they're done. There's a couple of details on, like, you know, Gigi talking about Komatsu. They mentioned, oh, you know, he heard a voice. So we don't really know what's going on there, but, you know, when we go into the spirit world, we might learn who that voice belonged to, and we get a conversation between Komatsu and Chako saying, like, oh, yeah, Chaku. You know, Chako saying, like, hey, you know, I'm gonna go do this, and then when all this is over with, I'm sure you're gonna see your mom again, and that's pretty much it. Then they set off, and Dawn Slam leads them into the spirit world. That's the chapter.
Yeah, there's not a lot. It's still that kind of weird point where we know how this all ends because we saw the end of it. We're still in that flashback sort of thing. We have gotten a little bit more. I actually was able to kind of follow along with this chapter for the first time in a while, and I was able to follow, like, pick up on everything that's happening. You know, they're kind of hinting, like, who is this woman that Komatsu spoke with? And I've heard some people theorize that maybe that's his gourmet cell demon, because we know he has one after he got his heart back from Bambina and all that. And it also did explain, it's sort of like that weird Toriko logic, but they're like, actually, Acacia's meat dish news is basically like an inedible, tasteless thing as normally, like if you ate it right now. And they kind of explain it as like, ooh, could you eat that table over there? They're like, well, it might have nutrients, but it's, you know, completely indigestible to me. They're like, ah, but for termites, it is food. And what another will do is reinvigorate your palate, so even rocks will be tasty in the gourmet world, which is such a, like, goofy Toriko concept.
Anything
that I love.
You see is completely eatable. Edible.
Not just edible, delicious. Like, just the notion of, like,
you can eat almost anything you see.
Yeah, like, once you eat another, you're like, I will walk around and, like, there's a steak in front of me, but oh my god, these rocks, like this dog turd. I found that, like, actually kind of, like, a cute, fun, like, Toriko-esque logic to the world. So it's kind of interesting in that regard. Like, that's another's big thing, is it kind of, because it's also the tongue of the reinvigorated Acacia thing, so that's why it's, like, a kind of a big deal that this is one of the ingredients they get. They say it's just as important as center and God itself, basically, so. Hmm. Very interesting little bit there, but ultimately it is a chapter that just kind of ends with leading into stuff we already kind of know the conclusion of. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah. All right. So that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap. So, Chris, let's name our series of the week and weekly MVP. Our audience series of the week is, again, My Hero Academia, which is the second time that's happened in the past 3 weeks. My series of the week is going to be Nisekoi. It's not something that we cover in full a whole lot, which is why I knew this going in that it was going to be my series week, which is why I wanted to make sure we covered it. But I thought that this was, I mean, it was a very eventful chapter, actually, because there's some very important things that happen in it in terms of, like, okay, you know, we've got this main cast member is being, you know, taken out of the series, at least temporarily. She finally got through Raku's thick fucking skull that how he feels about Shitage, and that maybe we can actually move that plot forward somewhat. And in general, it was just, you know, a few nice scenes of, you know, she had good interactions with almost every other character in the cast, with Honda, with Raku, with Chitoge, with Onodera and Ruri. So, I mean, yeah, it was a charity that did its job in, you know, within a bottle, but also in terms of setting stuff up for later down the line that I'm really happy with.
Oh, that's very impressive. I kind of argued with myself quite a bit on this one, because I found this week of Jump to be very good overall. I think, like, every chapter...
Well, that's... I have the exact opposite impression, which is why I ended up going with
this one. I feel like every chapter had merit, but there was... Like, for basically every chapter, I had something that kind of held it back. Like, I was like, oh, Black Clover was amusing, but, you know, it was kind of also a little bit like, I don't know what's really going on, or, you know, it really isn't doing anything specific. You know, My Hero Academia had kind of a cool conclusion, but I wasn't really digging the stuff at the beginning. I think the only chapter I ended up thinking all the way through, was the best was Food Wars. I think that was just an excellent chapter all the way through this week. It didn't necessarily do a whole lot. We're, like, on the precipice of the conclusion, but I just love what we got out of Aizon.
Yeah, I get that, because you pointed out, like, I didn't, you know, you didn't want to do World Trigger last week because it seemed like the beginning of something, but, I think it was, I mean, Aizon's thing was done a lot more effectively than World Trigger's was last week, I feel.
Well, I think I'm also just enjoying it because this, in a way, it's a build-up to a conclusion. With the whole Kitora Osamu thing, the main point to get out of that is eventually Osamu's going to get the development. Like, that's right. Going to hit him, and that's going to be the payoff. This is a payoff to Aizon and just the audience questioning for a very long time, you know, what is this guy's capabilities? Is he just a dude with a lot of money and an attitude and a shitty, like, kind of underhanded way of winning contests? I like the fact that it was a way to kind of showcase, no, he is a money guy, he is big behind the scenes, but this is a guy you should not sleep on. He's just as talented as anyone else in the Council of Ten, and maybe more talented than you even realize. Like, I like that explanation because it adds a lot more weight to this battle.
And for the same reasons, Aizon is my weekly MVP. I thought that Food Wars overall could have been a bit better, but I was very impressed with the build-up that Aizon got, even if he made chicken broth with the chicken he was cooking, is the single most unimpressive feat in all of Food Wars so far, for my money. That's going to have to be, like, a fucking highlight of the year when we do the annual recap. It's so stupid. Who was your weekly MVP?
My weekly MVP was Maria, because I think it's super funny that her brother is now Aizon as well.
I actually did give a little bit of thought to
if you say to Maria, Gouche. I'm going to slap you.
To Gouche. I gave it a little bit of thought, because it's like, I think he's creepy as hell, but he was super fucking memorable.
Yeah,
he's a hell of an impression. But yeah, no, got to be Aizon. I agree. So, yeah, that is it. So, audience is My Hero Academia. I say Nisko, you say Food Wars, and we both say Aizon from Food Wars. So, good showing from Food Wars all around this week, I would say. Actually, let me make sure that I'll
Ooh,
drop...
Actually, before we get into that, I just want
to
note...
I'm just going to drop the link to the document so everyone can see it.
For everybody who's listening right now, if you're listening to it live or you're listening to a recording... The November bonus pod for our Patreons is out. It's the review of the last Naruto the movie. It's not the last Naruto movie. It's just called The Last.
It's The Last Naruto the movie.
Yeah. It's out there if you guys want to check it out. It's a very fun review. I know a lot of people have kind of been wanting to hear our thoughts on it. It's a continuation of Naruto November, and we hope everybody enjoys it. And at the last week of the month, I want to kind of always announce what the next one's going to be. Next month, our bonus pod, I am very happy to announce, is going to be a radio play where we are going to be taking a twist on the classic Christmas Carol story. It's called A Bleach Christmas Carol, where Nick is going to be visited by the ghosts of Bleach past, present, and future as they try to reinvigorate his love of Bleach, called Why Me Scrooged?
Why Me Scrooge?
Yes, after the famous Bleach chapter, Why Me Sad.
Oh, right. Yeah. God.
So, it is going to be... It's going to be a shit ton of work into it. Like, I'm in the process of writing it and just, like, processing the amount of, like, effects and stuff I'm going to need to do to capture, like, the story.
You may actually have to edit this one.
Oh, there's going to be an absurd amount of editing, because some of the people I'm planning to have
voice on it. We're not going to be in one call, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get some of those stuff. But it is going to be an immense amount of work, but it is going to be absolutely worth it. So make sure you are, if you're interested in it, that you get in with the Patreon for the month of December.
Mm-hmm. And go ahead.
It's still going to be the World Trigger to My Heart and all that's going to be like on a regular episode, so... Right.
Yeah, special thanks go out to all of our Patreon supporters, because your support allows us to create all sorts of bonus content for you guys to enjoy, like those bonus episodes, like the live streams of movies that we do, and like the question and answer episodes that, and I guess the next one should be coming out relatively soon, because we're going to probably have to do it early in December again, because, you know, all that holiday stuff. If anyone has a good title for the live movie streams that we do, then we're taking suggestions. We need a catchy, snappy category title. So you guys get to work on that, please.
Thanks to Paulin Cabrios, who is our most recent patron. I greatly appreciate your support. We do, rather.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us here on Kitbox.tv/ReloadC, where we normally record the show Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change things up. For example, record on Tuesday this week. But to stay updated on all that stuff, you can follow the official Weekly Manga Recap Twitter account, which is at WMR Podcast, and you can follow the hosts individually at ReloadC and at YRiller of Time. Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, and also subscribe to us on iTunes. Plus, be sure to leave a comment or rating so that you can help us beat the woodworkers.
Someone has to do it. It's almost fucking Christmas time, everybody. For once, I want to go underneath the Christmas tree on Christmas morning, and I want to open up good ratings on iTunes. The Dark Might's helping us out. He says, these guys might not know the major differences between Mayo and Miracle Rip, but their manga critiquing skills are top-notch.
I forgot all about that conversation we had. What a reference. Jeez. Be sure to also send us criticism, ask us questions, suggest future manga for us to read. You can send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks finally go out to Steve Mann, our talk artist, who has all sorts of different locations you can check out his artwork at. There's neurogfanboy.deviantart.com, idriveboobs.tumblr.com, patreon.com/stevemann, all sorts of stuff. And special thanks as well go out to the Infamous Planet, as well as Felix Dark, for the visual editions of our podcast.
That's something more sensual than anything. Like you were trying to whisper him sweet nothings.
I gotta find different ways to emphasize the every single time, so. Fuck you too, Infamous Planet. Oh, God. That's it. So we are still continuing to work on Siren. We'll have that probably sooner rather than later, but we're still working on that. And that's it for Weekly Manga Recap, Chris.
Yeah, that's gonna do it. Nick, also though, like totally off topic, but I feel like a good way to close out this episode, the Bucks, man!
Yeah!
They're in the playoff hunt.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll see how things are in another month or so, but for the time being, beat the Eagles.
Oh, yeah. You didn't just beat the Eagles, you just bent them over a table at home.
We did not take them. Look, for a victory that complete, we did not bend them over a table. No, we showed them that we really cared. We took them, laid out all the rose petals on the bed, lit some candles and stuff, kissed them tenderly on the cheek, and then gave them all sorts of oral foreplay and stuff, and then we fucked the fuck out of them.
This was a deliberate fucking.
It was slow, and it was sensual, and it was complete.
And at the end of it, you did not leave your number for them to call you back. It was a one-time thing, and now you're gone.
Oh, God. I think we're done.